Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast. I'm your contributing guest host and aspiring Gen Z home renter, Eric Bond. I'm taking the old what-if machine on an expeditionary mission today to the mid-19th century to make like the fray and save a life and show you all just how difficult that is. You may be wondering whose life we are trying to save, unless you read the episode's description, in which case, no spoilers, but it's not Edgar Allan Poe. So please take any red-masked balls or 1,000 injuries of Fortunato you have borne as best you could and wall them in for another day, because we have got a one William Henry Harrison to save. However, please also, if you have any ideas about saving Edgar Allan Poe's life, feel free to send them in to our website. Now, who is William Henry Harrison? If you don't know, I don't blame you. He was only the 9th president of the United States for a total of 31 days before succumbing to a mysterious illness that was half-heartedly diagnosed as pneumonia by his attending physician, Dr. Thomas Miller. Now, if you have heard about Harrison at all growing up like I did, it probably would have been for one of two things. One, that he was called Tippecanoe for a famous battle in which he defeated the forces commanded by the Shawnee religious leader Tenskwatawa, who was also known as the Prophet and was the brother of the much more renowned Shawnee leader Tecumseh. The second thing you might know William Henry Harrison for, or Tippecanoe, as we have come to know him, is that he died because he gave a really long speech, lasting 2 hours, on a cold, rainy day without a coat, a hat, or gloves, to show just his sheer vitality at age 68. The fact that he was 68 had been a major sticking point for potential voters in the 1840 election, the fear being that he would be too feeble to effectively manage his office or even die before taking his oath. Arguably, Harrison had proven them wrong on both counts. Harrison tried to assure voters that he would only serve one term, which, again, was a promise he arguably followed through on, which is ever the rarity for any campaigning politicians now or then. For our what did today, I think it is best to first highlight the career of William Henry Harrison, then what killed him, followed by what were the primary issues of this age, especially because Part 2 will be covering the after effects of the new timeline I'm setting up here. So, let's begin and see what killed Old Tip and see how we can save him. William Henry Harrison was born to a prestigious Virginian planter family on February 9th of 1773. This would make him the last president to have been born a British citizen. In fact, William Henry Harrison would often comment with pride that he was a child of the Revolution. He was a son of Benjamin Harrison, who was a signatory of the Declaration of Independence and a governor of Virginia. Now, William Henry Harrison, or Billy, as he was called growing up, was the 7th son. And as anyone who has ever seen Frozen will tell you, the more sons there are, the less there is to inherit when the patriarch dies. William Henry Harrison would find this out for himself when he was 18. His eldest brother had sent him a letter saying that he needed to find a less expensive apprenticeship. William Henry Harrison just so happened to be studying medicine under fellow signer of the Declaration of Independence and slave owner Dr. Benjamin Rush. Now, This is to his credit. Dr. Rush did free his slave, William Gruber, though it is never signified at what time or how long William served as a slave to Dr. Rush. Just something to bear in mind. Now, Harrison, receiving this letter, decided to join the army in 1791. He had distinguished himself through the campaigns against indigenous Americans who were trying to resist white encroachment. Through his service, he married Anna Sims and had 10 children, most of whom would unfortunately not live to see adulthood. At this point, Harrison would often jump between military and political. In one episode of the continuing failures of William Henry Harrison, he had attempted to follow in the footsteps of a family friend of the Harrisons, namely George Washington, in trying to become a whiskey distiller. Now, unfortunately for William Henry Harrison, the whiskey he distilled made him so incredibly ill that he swore off any alcohol for the remainder of his life, except hard cider, that is. He would actually try to promote teetotalism, meaning temperance, essentially, in that time period among soldiers. This, of course, like many things for Harrison, did not work. If you're getting the idea that Harrison might be, perhaps, eaten up inside by his numerous failures and also constant deprivations by his brothers and seemingly fate, well, you would not be wrong. According to many people who spoke with Harrison privately, he could be genial, amiable, and just a great time, but he would tell you how much the party he was throwing was costing him. Needless to say, this did not win him many close friends after extended contact. However, let us not feel too bad for William Henry Harrison, because like many Southern aristocrats of the time, he of course owned slaves. One of whom, Decilla, would later be impregnated by Harrison, resulting in 6 additional children, one of whom eventually leading to the birth of Kenneth White, who was a leader of the NAACP during the 1930s and 40s. Now, for the sake of brevity and to avoid this becoming just a William Henry Harrison fan cast, let me run through a quick list of his accomplishments and positions that he held before becoming president. He served as a 2-year delegate to the House of Representatives for the Northwest Territory. He served as governor of Indian Territories, this being the land composing of Indiana, Michigan, Illinois, and parts of Minnesota between 1801 and 1812. He served as a House representative between 1816 and 1819 for Ohio, later becoming the senator from Ohio from 1825 to 1828. Lastly, he served as a diplomat to Simon Bolivar's Gran Colombia between 1828 and 1829. Now, the reason why that diplomatic posting had been so short was Andrew Jackson quickly fired him, especially after Harrison wrote basically a letter saying that Gran Colombia was nothing more than a military dictatorship posing as a republic. In his military efforts, he served as a major general during the War of 1812. Now, as a politician, he strove to represent the interests of frontiersmen and making land easier to purchase from the federal government. This, of course, brought him into the same circles of Andrew Jackson, who was the other major general during the War of 1812 to actually have some sort of recognizable victory. However, since they don't call it the Age of Harrison, you can imagine who was more popular. Especially, a drag on Harrison's reputation was the fact that he stayed mostly silent on any issue that actually mattered to most people, such as slavery or tariffs or anything that could make someone say, "I think you're wrong." In fact, he would earn the nickname General Mum for this effort. Now, we come to the part at last I know we've all been waiting for. So, how do we save William Henry Harrison from dying on April 4th of 1841? Well, in order to save him, we have to first figure out what killed him. Now, like I said before, his attending physician, the Dr. Thomas Miller, had diagnosed the president with having pneumonia, probably resulting from some sort of infection in the lower lobe of his left lung. That's a lot of L's to say. Now, this was not the chief reason for his illness. He had developed a cough during his treatment, but that was not the initial reason for the doctor being called. In fact, it was actually, well, he had severe constipation and abdominal pain. He believed the abdominal pain came from his having nerve damage from the various battles he fought during his life. As for the constipation, he had no idea, but had, as I mentioned before, always had a sensitive stomach and regularly fasted to help manage his symptoms. So, in order to help with the constipation, the doctor then proceeded to prescribe mercury-infused laxatives, often 4 to 5 a day, every day. This did not seem to help the president's condition, and in fact may have also inflamed the pain even more so. So now we're also going to add laudanum, also known as opium, into the mix. So, mercury on one side, opium on the other, and one very dead Harrison by April 4th of 1841, followed by a constitutional crisis resulting in John Tyler, the vice president who didn't really even want to be vice president. He had slunk off back to his home in Virginia, just intending to collect a paycheck for the remainder of the term, declaring himself the new president. So, why do we think it was pneumonia? Well, according to Dr. Thomas Miller's notes on the issue, he didn't really know what to make of the whole sickness, but the cough sounded like pneumonia to him, along with some pink-colored phlegm the president had coughed out. So, pneumonia it is, pneumonia it has been, and every time somebody ever wanted to say, you should wear a coat out, you have Harrison to thank. So how are we going to save this guy? Well, it would be very difficult to imagine somebody prescribing a cure for what we have now come to decide is either the case of typhoid or some kind of gastroenteritis, which would later fell Presidents Zachary Taylor and James K. Polk. So, no medical miracles on that front. In fact, I even tried to sketch out a plan to where Harrison could have become president during the election of 1836 before I realized that that was a mathematical improbability. During that election, the Whig Party, which Harrison belonged to, had attempted to run 4 separate candidates at the same time against Martin Van Buren, Andrew Jackson's vice president. So, running for the Whigs was William Henry Harrison, Hugh L. White, Daniel Webster, and Willie P. Magnum. Now, you might be wondering why run 4 presidential candidates instead of 1. Well, the Whigs did not think they could win with just 1 candidate, so they thought, if we can deprive Van Buren of getting enough electoral college votes, it'll pass to the House of Representatives, and then the House of Representatives will vote in one of our candidates. This is exactly what had happened to Andrew Jackson during his initial campaign to become president in 1824, resulting in the election of John Quincy Adams by the House of Representatives. Of course, this could not possibly work. The main reason being, none of the Whigs collectively had enough electoral votes to throw it into question, nor did any of them have enough to surpass Martin Van Buren's 170 votes. Counting up all of them, they would have had a collective 124, even if it was just William Henry Harrison. So that's a 1 medical miracle out. We can't have him become president in 1836, so that's out. So, knowing that it's something to do with typhoid and gastroenteritis, I had to look up the history of plumbing in the White House. I legitimately thought I was going to be put on some kind of watch list, like I was attempting to do my own sequel to National Treasure, where I have to break into the White House. Thankfully, I have not been on a watch list to my knowledge yet. So, when did the White House get plumbing? That's right. Plumbing, like a basilisk at a magical children's school. We're using the plumbing, folks. Well, Andrew Jackson, our good old ghost character in this drama, had installed iron pipes in the ground floor corridor and bathing room in the east wing of the White House in 1833. This was supposed to be pumped in from a local spring on Franklin Square, which was just a few miles away from the White House. Now, what nobody quite understood about the iron pipes was that they quickly rusted, especially when human fecal matter from a nearby cesspit started flowing into the water supply. So, you're taking a shower, it's all nice, you're feeling good and jolly. Oh, wait, this is infused with human poop. You are bathing in poop. And I'm so sorry that you have to imagine this, but this is just the historical reality in this alternate timeline that I am trying to create. So please bear with me. Well, were there any alternatives to this rusted iron piping infused with human fecal matter? There was. They could have gone with wooden pipes. This was another new thing I learned. Apparently, wooden pipes in plumbing is a thing, and it was especially a thing then. The only problem that kept wooden pipes from being used was they were afraid of them instantly combusting, especially after the White House had just been rebuilt after the British torched the place during the War of 1812. So, let us imagine a timeline. Andrew Jackson in 1833, free run of the place, $45,000 to spend. What's he gonna do? He is going to save some money and get some nice wooden pipes for the White House. They are secure, they're safe, and he's old hickory. Why wouldn't he go with a tree-based solution for a plumbing problem? That metaphor escaped me, but we are carrying on. Here's where another problem presents itself, unfortunately. In 1836, after Martin Van Buren had become president, he will have to contend with the U.S. Patent Office going up in flames. That's right, the U.S. Patent Office, the only federal building to be spared by the British during the War of 1812, somehow combusted on December 5th of 1836. So, you're Martin Van Buren, you've served your time as vice president, you have been sworn in after a hard election, only to find you must now rebuild the White House, the second time it must be done in a country that is barely 50 years old. I'm sure you love to be you at this point. So, the White House has been in flames from its nearby location to the U.S. Patent Office. The wooden pipes have combusted just as the engineers had warned, and it's just another log on the fire for Van Buren's political future, paving the way for Tippecanoe and Tyler II to take the White House in 1840. Tyler gets to give his fanciful two-hour speech about the problems with the Constitution, but how much he swears to abide by it. Yes, you can look it up. I'll include it in our show notes. And now, with new pipes, new plumbing, and hopefully no cesspits nearby, William Henry Harrison can finally begin his term in earnest. Now, for this, we're going to split it between two subsections, foreign and domestic policy. We're going to start with foreign affairs first, just because there will be less of them. During this time, the main competition for territory on the North American continent was between Britain and Mexico. For Britain, it was trying to decide who would manage the territory of Oregon, which had been co-managed by the British and American government, but Americans were pushing for a new border set at the 54th parallel instead of the 49th parallel, which it became in our timeline. Now, it had been resolved with a border treaty in 1842 with the Webster-Ashburton Treaty that was signed by then-President John Tyler. But in this timeline, the White House has just been burnt down. It's bringing up the memories of the War of 1812, and William Henry Harrison finally gets to make use of the fame that was rightfully his after all this time, if it weren't for Andrew Jackson. So, I don't think he goes to war with the British for the Oregon Territory, but I think things are going to be extended out past his presidency. He has a population problem in that the burnt down capital has just reignited those old enmities towards the British. He also has his own personal pride to consider in that he wants to make sure that he makes another win against British forces and Canadian forces. So we're going to assume that he pushes off any such treaty making. No war, just cooling any diplomatic relations between the US and Britain. Now with Mexico, that's going to be a different issue altogether. White Anglo colonists were going into Texas and California, which were then territories owned by Mexico, introducing slavery, which was not an acceptable outcome for the Mexican government, and attempting to filibuster. Filibuster we had described briefly before in a prior episode. Essentially, enough colonists move into a territory, declare themselves an independent country, and attempt to get annexed by the United States. This would happen during the 1830s and 40s with Texas, where they would attempt to have the U.S. annex them and add them as part of the country. Now, Harrison, for all of his flaws, does not want just war for war's sake. He does not want war to increase his own glory. As with the British, this is probably going to be one where General Mum just punts it down for later in the year. He only has to get by these 4 years. If he can delay it long enough, it'll be the next guy's problem. Now, that does bring us to domestic policy. We're first going to start with the policy towards Indigenous Americans. Now, this is the period where Andrew Jackson had begun the process and then saw it carried out by Martin Van Buren, known as the Trail of Tears, where after the Supreme Court had ruled that Cherokees could remain on their land, Jackson said, "You and what army?" and deported them anyway, past the Mississippi. I wish I could say I was joking about that, but it was true. Andrew Jackson said to the Supreme Court, "What army do you have to carry out your decision?" None. And forced troops to depose the Cherokee and other indigenous groups. So, in the newly acquired Florida territory, there is something called the Seminole Wars between Seminole and Miami tribes versus the U.S. troops and white colonists attempting to take their land. I do think we would probably see the establishment of Native American schools as we did in our own timeline, as Harrison favored what he called assimilation. He felt it was their duty as an advanced, quote-unquote advanced, society to share all of their benefits with their native neighbors. This is not going to be a rosy issue by any means, but this is what Harrison would most likely do. Either you leave, die, or start acting white. The other main issue that he had promised during his election campaign for the 1840 election was that he would establish a national bank. During Jackson's terms, he had closed the Second National Bank, And essentially, it caused a financial crisis during 1836, as the value of U.S. dollars essentially collapsed as each bank was putting out competing banknotes. So one of the first thing that on the domestic agenda is to establish a new national bank. Now, Nicholas Biddle of the Pennsylvania Biddle banking clans had unfortunately died before the election had finished, so he could not be reinstated. I would argue that at this point, Harrison would probably choose John Biddle. John Biddle was the former mayor of Detroit and was a delegate from the Michigan Territory, and was also a veteran of the War of 1812, serving as a major during that war. For this, Harrison could appease his benefactors. In fact, there is a news article where basically they were examining where the money was coming from Harrison's campaign, and it was all coming from Nicholas Biddle to help him defeat the Jacksonian Democrats. So he definitely has an incentive to install a member of the Biddle family. John Biddle, in our own timeline, later became associated with train companies and did serve in financial roles. So he has training, he has experience, he's another veteran, so he's an easy sell to the Senate to confirm him. So we're going to see paper money backed by a gold standard. This will also probably spark conversations among citizens about whether or not to start using silver to also back the currency. Now, the main issue we are definitely going to see in this timeline is the issue of slavery. Like I said before, Harrison himself was a slave owner, though he was kind of half-hearted and said, you know, I'm not fond of slavery, but I do own slaves. And, you know, it would just be so great if we could just send all the African Americans away, and then we wouldn't have to worry about slavery. Because if we finish slavery today, the problem is all these African Americans will start demanding equal rights like they were citizens, just because they were born here. Now, you might be thinking, well, yes, why wouldn't they? But you have to understand, for Harrison and for the South and for any slave owners, they were not people, they were capital and a means of production for them to profit. And if they can't have that profit, well, they'd rather just not have them on the board at all. So we would also probably see the start of free soil. However, Harrison did not want interference from the government. He felt that this was purely something to be decided by each state. He had attempted to bring slavery to Indiana, but had been rebuffed by his fellow colonists at the time. So I think we would definitely see him start to try and negotiate a deal between the different factions of the Whig Party, which were composed of Northern nascent abolitionists. Again, they were more of the free soil model that we see of Henry Clay, to where they're like, we don't want slavery, but we don't want black people to have rights, so let's send them to Liberia. This becomes a whole issue of in itself in our own timeline. The Whigs were also composed of, as I said, Southern Democrats who hated Andrew Jackson, like his vice president, John Tyler. So that's not going to be a healthy mix for a cohesive political unit, as such was the case in our own timeline. Now, what we might see is something like what precipitated Bleeding Kansas, in that he would try to push the idea of, well, what if every state, when they became a state, could decide whether or not they wanted to be slave or free states, or if he would try to maintain the compromise where, past a certain parallel, You can't have a free state without also having a slave state beneath it. So these are the things we're going to see. If I'm putting my money on anything, I think either he'll try to again punt it off for the next president, or be fully in favor of each territory deciding whether or not they become a slave or free state. But again, he's going to push that off as much as he can. Meanwhile, he's probably building up the Navy and the Army. This was a major concern of his when he served as a non-voting delegate for the Northwest Territory, in that he argued a standing army was a necessity for their security. So we would probably see the building up of steam-powered battleships, such as the USS Princeton, which he would be happily touring on in February 27th of 1844. While touring the decks, the captain is convinced to fire off the pacemaker artillery cannon for his guests. So these guests would include notable figures such as Dolly Madison, several senators like David Gardner from New York, even the Secretary of the Navy, George Badger, would be there, and Secretary of State Daniel Webster. And they would all die as a result of the artillery exploding, spreading shrapnel on the deck and quickly killing all of them. So we've gone from old hickory to old kindling very, very quickly. I never said that he would survive his first term, but I would save him from the fate of gastroenteritis. Now, what we're going to see next, you're going to have to tune in next week for part two as we cover the aftermath of this timeline, which I am calling the Old Kindling World. And just a little hint for our next episode, I will tell you this now. With a plumbing system that has been reworked, that means we might see a Zachary Taylor fulfill his full term, not to mention James K. Polk. That's right, the Napoleon of the Stump, surviving past his initial term as president as well. So we hope you tune in next time. If you want to support the show, please go on to Patreon, where for just 8 silver quarters, that's right, only $2, you can become a member. You can make a one-time donation on podfan.com or go to our store at tpublic.com to where you can get such fun mugs and t-shirts bearing our logo. Until next time, if you see that fork in the road, take it. This has been Eric Bond, signing off.